Greetings and welcome to the Audio Tidbits Podcast Network. We hope you enjoy the show.
Samuel Johnson said, "Courage is reckoned the greatest of all virtues, because, unless a man has that virtue, he has no security for preserving any other." The point was further clarified by C.S. Lewis, "Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point. That testing point comes when the consequences of virtue are both certain and frightening. At that moment, courage, according to Ambrose Redmond, is not the absence of fear, but rather the judgment that something else is more important than fear. What to do? You know what is right, what you ought to do, but are fearful, want very much to avoid the expected consequences of virtue. At that moment of indecision, follow Mark Rutherford's guidance. When we are afraid, we ought not to occupy ourselves with endeavoring to prove that there is no danger, but in strengthening ourselves to go on in spite of the danger." As Dan Rather said, "Courage is being afraid but going on anyhow." As you take a deep breath and then do what you know you ought to do, it will help to remind yourself of Mignon McLaughlin's simple truth: courage can't see around corners, but goes around them anyway.
Have you heard this before? "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious." Get serious, Professor Einstein. Your humility may be charming, but slips a tad in the verisimilitude department. Even so, you did say, "The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. One cannot help but be in awe when he contemplates the mysteries of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. It's like Sudi Bak pointed out, be curious always, for knowledge will not acquire you. You must acquire it." Eleanor Roosevelt said, "I think, at a child's birth, if a mother could ask a fairy godmother to endow it with the most useful gift, that gift should be curiosity." Fairy godmothers or not, the one real object of education is to have a man in a condition of continually asking questions. Bishop Mandel Creighton was of a mind with Arnold Edinburgh, who said, "Curiosity is the very basis of education, and if you tell me that curiosity killed the cat, I say only the cat died nobly." Just be sure to remember this from Rudyard Kipling: "I keep 6 honest serving men, they taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who."
Kids, they dance before they learn there's anything that isn't music. William Stafford certainly makes a valid point about the spontaneous enthusiasm of children. The disappointing message here is less obvious though. Too quickly, children do learn much of their world isn't music. Having learned that lesson, they gradually dance less and less and then finally just stop dancing. It's as if they never knew how. The childlike spontaneous enthusiasm for life is little more than an abstract concept, a topic for polite conversation. They can talk about dancing, but no one dances, even though, as Peter St. James said, "Talk about dance? Dance is not something to talk about. Dance is to dance." Samuel Beckett reinforced the point: dance first, think later. It's the natural order. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche observed, "And those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music." Stafford thought that children hear everything as music, but that gradually changes. They evolve into those who neither hear the music nor dance. And sooner or later, everyone evolves. There is a Japanese proverb that says, "We're fools whether we dance or not, so we might as well dance." The key is in remembering to hear the music.
It's not surprising no one takes credit for saying, "A balanced diet is a cookie in each hand." The same holds for whoever said, "I am a nutritional overachiever." Nonetheless, Gertrude Louise Cheney was definitely on target when she said, "All people are made alike, of bones and flesh and dinner, only the dinners are different." It really is tough to argue with H.S. Lee, who advised, "If you wish to grow thinner, diminish your dinner." The famous Annan pointed out, "Stress spelled backwards is desserts." Coincidence? I think not. Life does have its ups and downs, and learning food can soothe the troubled times is hardly a new discovery. Still, Philip C. McGraw issued an important caution: reality check, you can never, ever, use weight loss to solve problems that are not related to your weight. at your goal weight or not, you still have to live with yourself and deal with your problems. Fortunately, there is more advice from the famous Anonymous. Don't go out of your way to please anyone but yourself. Follow the counsel of Cyril Connolly. The one way to get thin is to re-establish a purpose in life. As Julia Child said, life itself is the proper binge. If you're not quite up to this high philosophical stance, perhaps you align more with Herbert P. Prochnow, who noted, a diet is a plan, generally hopeless, for reducing your weight, which tests your willpower but does little for your waistline. Mignon McLaughlin likely at a point when he said, forget about calories, everything makes thin people thinner, and fat people fatter, just relax and nod in agreement with Roseanne Barr, who gets the final word on the subject. It's okay to be fat. So you're fat. Just be fat and shut up about it.
Samuel Butler said, the great pleasure of a dog is that you may make a fool of yourself with him, and not only will he not scold you, but he will make a fool of himself too. Cats, to the contrary, conspire to keep us at arm's length, according to Frank Perkins. Holbrook Jackson said, man is a dog's idea of what God should be. Cats, to the contrary, have never completely got over the snootiness caused by that fact that in ancient Egypt they were worshipped as gods, according to P.G. Woodhouse. In order to keep a true perspective of one's importance, everyone should have a dog that will worship him and a cat that will ignore him, advises Derek Bruce. The important distinctions were further enumerated by George Mikes. You can keep a dog, but it is the cat who keeps people, because cats find humans useful domestic animals. And James Gorman added, cats are the ultimate narcissists. You can tell this because of all the time they spend on personal grooming. Dogs aren't like this. A dog's idea of personal grooming is to roll on a dead fish. You have it from Jenny DeVries. You own a dog but you feed a cat. From the famous Anon you get this, dogs have owners, cats have staff. And Taylor added, dogs eat. Cats dine. And one more from Alfred North Whitehead, if a dog jumps into your lap, it is because he is fond of you. But if a cat does the same thing, it is because your lap is warmer. This could go back and forth ad infinitum. But let each side have one last turn. Roger Carras speaks for the dogs. Dogs have given us their absolute all. We are the center of their universe. We are the focus of their love and faith and trust. They serve us in return for scraps. It is without a doubt the best deal man has ever made. For the cats, Arthur Bridges said, a cat isn't fussy, just so long as you remember he likes his milk in the shallow, rose-patterned saucer and his fish on the blue plate.